Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Yes, welcome to the Tennis Show on Love Sport Radio. Me, Matt Beadle, here with tennis journalist Abigail Johnson and Ross Sattar and tennis pro Anna Smith. I said it had been an explosive start before this show started, and I can't quite believe it. I'm looking forward to this, ladies, because there's three of you here. I'm pretty sure you're going to do all the talking, but we will start with Kyle Edmund. He's just bowed out in the second round. What happened, Ross?
Looks like his knee kind of gave way, or an injury to... I think it actually was cited as a groin injury in the end, because it was a slip in the third set. And then from there, he never really got back on terms. Vadasco, if you open the door, will just go charging through it with reckless abandon. So, yeah, five-set loss for Kyle. A bit disappointing.
It looked like it was all in his favour, especially at the end of the second set when Vadasco almost avoided the lob, right, and handed Edmund the set, basically.
Edmund looked so surprised.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't remember seeing anything like that in a long time, at Wimbledon in particular. But the fact that the slip occurred in the third set, Anna, appeared to be the undoing of him.
I think it sort of just affected him a little bit mentally. You know, he's obviously had knee problems in the past, and I think maybe that was just a little bit playing on his mind as well. Probably didn't feel as confident, and then it just looked like he kind of backed off a little bit and was a bit passive. And I don't know, it just seems like he lost confidence. And then from there on, once Vadasco goes on a bit of a roll, it's hard to stop him with his lefty serve and that big forehand that he possesses.
Absolutely. Abigail, it's a bit of a shock, right? Because we were hoping this was going to be a big tournament for Kyle.
Yeah, you know, once he got that 2-0 advantage, I thought he was going through. I mean, you never want to give an outright prediction because it's so unpredictable over best of five. But Fernando Vadasco is on fire on his day, yeah. But grass courts, he's not his best, you know. He's never really soared on that particular surface. So, it's a big disappointment for Kyle because... And I think, you know, with the best of five set format, that's when it becomes really mental, when you've had that lead and the other player's creeping back and then they're on the rise and they're kind of gaining momentum, and it's so much harder, I feel anyway, from an outsider's perspective, for that person that's had the advantage to begin with to actually try and get that back, because it's almost like sand through your fingers. You can feel it kind of slipping away, I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree, actually. I think we saw it with James Ward as well in the first round. He had that two-set lead. And then as soon as Basilashvili started to get back at him, you could just see him, like, visibly slump. You know, first one, the third, it's like, no, well, OK, I'm still 2-1 up. And then when it was all level, it was like, oh, no, don't make me go to a fifth.
It's so tough, isn't it? And, I mean, looking at the first round, I think 13 seeds in total went out in the first round. 6 on the men's side, 7 on the women's. Of those that fell... Which are we calling actual shocks? I mean, it was outside of seeds as well, you know, Venus Williams, Grigor Dimitrov, so many other big names going out. Which of them were you actually really genuinely surprised by? Because we look at the slams to date and so many big names are going out early on. It's difficult to say sometimes. Anna, do you have any particular name that jumps to mind?
Not massively. I think you just have to look at the fact that apart from or outside the big three in the guys, basically anyone is... capable of beating anyone. I don't think there's a specific name that obviously is shocking to go out. I suppose maybe you look at like Dominic Thiem, obviously he made the final at the French, but then you look at the fact that he played Queries. Mm-hmm. Is that really, was he ever considered the favourite maybe for that match? Because obviously he wouldn't say he's got grass court pedigree, whereas Queries obviously, did he make semis?
Yeah, he made semis last year. He made the final of Eastbourne after an 11-week layoff with an abdominal injury. So, you know, he's coming in with a fair bit of momentum. You're right, there's nobody, you know, when we saw the draw and saw Osaka and Putintseva, especially after Birmingham and the whole debacle in Birmingham, I think it's unheard of for Osaka not to even come into press on a loss. And she did come into press, but cut it short, you know. But it was always on the cards because Putintseva on her day can really be tricky. Plus, Osaka seems to have it in her head that she just can't deal with grass. In fact, the whole of the European swing, I think, is a big bugbear for her.
Osaka, I just want to touch on this because watching her, again, Putintseva, you just thought she didn't want to be there. It was very, very strange. There's something in her body language, in her expression, that she, like you said, she's got this mental battle on grass, but she just, it felt like she didn't want to be there.
Yeah, in her sort of preview in Birmingham, she was kind of very non-committal about the grass. It's like, meh, it's green and it's slippery and I'm not really sure I like it. And she just had that kind of look about her. Plus, I think that kind of angry recognition over the net of you. Oh, Lord. So, yeah. And she was like that in Stuttgart as well, at the beginning of the clay court season, where she's like, you know, every time I come to Europe, I injure myself. It doesn't go well. I think once you start getting that in your head, you know, Halep is the same. She's reached the semi-finals and she's like, oh, grass, I'm not sure. And it's like, you're a semi-finalist. What's the matter with you? And then she rolled her ankle then. And then she rolled her ankle again in the first round.
But stepping away from the mental issue with grass, I would also say for Osaka that it's not necessarily just the surface. If you look at the kind of opponent she's been losing to, who did she go out to at the French Open? Katerina Siniaková, doubles player, lots of variation in her game and the ability to make Osaka uncomfortable around the court. She's just lost to Putintseva twice. What was Putintseva doing? She was throwing so much shape on the forehand, drop-shotting, slicing, you know. It's that kind of thing that's really going to upend Osaka. She likes the power play, right? That's what we've seen from her. She kind of eats that up and redirects the ball. But when she's being made to move in the manner that Putintseva did to her, that's when she really struggles. And then I think that's when it comes to, oh, I'm on grass as well. I don't like the grass. Or I've been losing so many matches. There must be something wrong with me. Have you seen that happening, do you think, with the counterpunching players being the ones to really trouble her?
Certainly in this swing, it's been one after the other, and you know, I think she just adds that all together in this big whole God, I hate Europe mix that she seems to be in at the moment. But you know, she's going to have to find a way around that because she can't avoid them. But it's interesting you say that, because when it was Kerber Osaka last year, everybody thought this is going to be an amazing match, and you're right, Kerber's counterpunching undid her in a matter of minutes, and it was a real pounding. We're all like, oh, well, okay, then well, maybe early lunch.
Well, that's Naomi Osaka. We have to talk about the teen sensation, Corey Goff. 313th in the world, just 15 years old, has beaten five-time champion Venus Williams. She said that she's got posters of Serena on her bedroom wall. She said that Venus was one of the players that inspired her to be a tennis pro. Just an incredible result.
I mean, I can't say I'm shocked about it. I don't know about anyone else here. It just seemed like from the moment Venus stepped on the court, she just looked a bit flat and a bit sluggish. And you'd have thought she'd be so excited to come back to the court where she's probably had the most success. But she just looked like she just couldn't get anything going. Like, it was just like the body language wasn't great. Like, the ball striking wasn't great. Just everything was just a little bit off. And then you could see Corey just gaining momentum just once you got that first game under her belt. Then you could see the fist pumps coming out, and you just kind of I think I felt from like 2-all, I think I said to my mum, I was like, I think Corey's gonna win it. And I was just a bit like, I just didn't see how Venus could hurt her. Mm-hmm. You know, she was moving so well, hitting the ball so well, and she just looks so confident. And the fact that she's 15 years old is just mind-boggling, really.
I agree. I think Venus is step slow now, and you can see it. I don't think she's lost any of the power, but it's just that speed of getting to the ball, you know, the side to side, and even going forward, it just seems to be a little bit more laboured. And the more that match went on, the more it looked like that.
She looked like she just doubted herself as well. You know, before, oh, yeah, she'd hit the ball as hard as she could and she would just back herself every single time. But this time it just looked like she was a bit tentative. When she was going for a shot, she was like more like, oh, am I going to make it, rather than that fearless thing that we've known over the years. And it, you know, you could really tell there. She just didn't back herself, like, any of the serves. She wasn't really going for it. Like, the forehand, the volleys when she came forward, like, she was poking at the ball. It's like, like, she's a much better player than that.
Well, that gave me hope, though. I was like, oh, I do that? Hey.
Sorry, Abigail.
No, it's okay. I just think it's interesting to hear such real assessments of the match, because obviously with it being a big global story, everyone's cottoning on to 15-year-old upsets Wimbledon legend, and it is amazing, but you have to look at the details beneath it. And honestly, Venus said herself, she played a bad match. There's no way around it, you know. She was the one with all the pressure on her shoulders, and people assume, because of the age of this young girl, that she's the one coming out here under tremendous pressure, tremendous scrutiny. But actually, it's Venus Williams that's been asked for the past 7 or so years when she's going to retire. You know, she's the one that's coming out here with everything to prove. And this girl, who's had a solid support system around her, is coming out to play the match that they've essentially prepared her for. They've been waiting. I felt that 100%, that they were waiting for this matchup. She said it was her dream draw. Who says that, you know, when they're playing someone of the caliber of Venus Williams? And no, wasn't surprised at all by that one. I would have been more surprised, I think, if Venus won.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, to be fair, that you all make, because this is a 39-year-old Venus Williams, right? 39. So at some point in every sport, the greats are going to fall because they're ultimately too old. And then the young guns are going to come through. I've done a disservice, by the way, haven't I? I called her Corey, but she's adamant that she likes to be called Coco.
So she was she came up with this cute story about how her parents had realised once they were married that they got the same initials, and so they decided that all the kids would have the same initials as well. And because she was the firstborn, she was named after her dad, but with an I instead of an EY. But yeah, she prefers Coco. But I mean, she was a breath of fresh air because, I mean, if she can do all this now, so hit with that kind of power, come in, you know, be quite sharp at the net when she did come in. If this is what she's like when she's 15, imagine when she's filled out a bit and got a lot more shot selection, you know, a nouse behind her. She's going to be unbelievable. People often say, oh, you know, the women, why do you follow the women's tour? Why do you write about the women's tour? It's boring. I'm sorry, but right now it's probably the most exciting of the two, in my opinion.
She showed an incredible maturity as well. I don't know whether that's something that we should expect with young tennis players, but she said, the court is always the same size wherever you play, right? It's always the same size. The surroundings change. They get bigger. But if you block those out, it's just the same tennis court that you practice on day in, day out. So the fact that she could show that, and she even said, I don't know how to react to this. I don't know. I'm a 15-year-old girl, basically. I've cried after losing, but I've never cried after winning. And it's just, she seems like she's got her head on her shoulders. Her parents were saying that. There was a lovely bit from her coach who said that she's passionate, she's driven. I knew as soon as she came to see me that she was going to be a winner.
Yeah, she has maturity beyond her years. And despite the way Venus played, I mean, she didn't bring her best performance. That shouldn't take away from this definitely being the start of something. I mean, it's not like we didn't know this girl before. She reached the junior US Open final age 13, won junior French Open age 14. You know, she's been making steady progression, and this is the next step of that progression. Looking ahead to her second round, Magdalena Rybarikova, it's always difficult to back up the big wins, and she's facing a player with a very different game style who's going to mix it up and make her move a lot more. Against Venus, she was getting away a bit with some double faults at key moments, with sometimes just putting the ball back in court, but she's going to have to step up a game and attack a bit more, but all round be a bit more consistent, I think, in that match.
Can we also touch here, just before the break, teens in tennis, because obviously she's 15. We've seen this many times, especially in the women's game. I'm talking Martina Hingis, Maria Sharapova, Anna Kournikova, even Eugenie Bouchard, who came in. Some are successful, some not so much.
Yeah, it's tricky. And I mean, you might be able to give us more of an insight, but for me, it seems that transition from the juniors, where you're a very big fish in that particular pond, to the seniors is what upends most players. And it's just that transition that, you know, and you'll either have a really good breakout year. The second year might be a little bit fishy. And then it's all about that third year and how you do it. So we've seen it, for example, with Kazakina and Osaka to a certain extent. They had that amazing run to the Indian Wells final. And then obviously Osaka's arc went flying, and Kazakina has just like, basically been about as static as a moth in a flame. But, you know, she's just blown out. You know, I don't know what it'll take to get her going again.
A moth in a flame. Great way to end that first segment. After the break, we are going to be having a little Brit watch. Yeah, that's seven British reps who made the second round of Wimbledon, the highest number since 2006. Obviously, a 13-year wait was unlucky for some, but we're going to be talking about that after the break.
Love Sport.
Yes, this is Love Sport, and this is the Tennis Show with Matt Beadle, joined by Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith and Roz Satire. We are going to move on to a Brit watch in this section. Ladies, seven British reps reached the second round. Now, we know already that Heather Watson bowed out, as did Kyle Edmund. We're going to start with Heather Watson. Quite a comprehensive defeat, would you say, Anna?
They both looked nervy at the start. I think there were a few breaks and no one could seem to get a foothold in the match. And then obviously, I think it was 7-5 in that first set, and it was just, I don't know, it's just, I think it's just a bit indicative of Heather's game at the moment. It's just like she's fighting so hard, and just can't quite seem to get those close victories at the moment. But, you know, it's a tough one. Annette's playing well. She's obviously got Nigel Sears in her corner as well, so he knows Heather's game sort of very well. It was a tough one. She did well to get through the first one, and then I don't know, she'll probably be disappointed with today, but I suppose Annette was always the favourite going into it.
Yeah, she was pretty disappointed and impressed. She seemed to be, I think she realised that was an opportunity lost, because Annette started the year pretty well. She had that big sort of purple patch between Miami and Stuttgart where she made the final. And then since Stuttgart, she's pretty much fallen off a cliff. She was really struggling for wins. So this was an opportunity. If Heather was back to her usual self, then this would have been, I would have been fairly confident of a win. But even when I was writing the preview, it was like, oh, if she pulls it to three, I'd give Heather the opportunity to get it. But yeah, as soon as Conto it started to run away with it in the second set, I kind of knew it was done.
It's just patches of good tennis from Heather, just couldn't quite string it together enough. It looked like it was, you could see some of the attacking play. It just looked like she was a little bit too defensive. I know she's kind of a counterpuncher, but it just looked like she was holding back a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love the fact that she added more aggression to her game a few years ago, because she knew that she wouldn't be able to get away with the big power hitters by playing the defensive game that she's got. But the beauty is she can switch to that defence when she needs to. But I don't think she needed to as much today. And I think that showed.
Well, we've touched on Edmund going out in the second round earlier in the show. Just talked a bit about Watson, but we had quite a bit of success in that first round with all the players coming through. Now, of this seven players that moved through, six of them had opponents that were ranked below them. So really, we're looking at this as they've won the matches they should have won. Who was the most impressive in that department, and who's the most likely to go further? And I'm going to come to Anna just because she knows some of these guys, so she might give us some insight.
I don't know why I always get put on the spot. I think you've got to look at Dan Evans, just the purely based on the amount of matches he's had over the grass court season and the success that he's had. Mm. And obviously the game style, you know, I think has he made third round or fourth? Is it a fourth?
Yeah.
Third or fourth? Here at Wimbledon.
Keep going and I'll find
either way.
He's
had a lot of success and obviously he's proven that he's done very well. And then Joe, obviously, she's made semi-finals here before, so you know you think that she's got a good chance as well. But then I don't know, like obviously Jay's got Federer next round. I don't think anyone's expecting him to do anything against that. But I don't know. I think once you have the British crowd on your back and behind you, then kind of anything's possible. I'm not expecting any of them to sort of make second week or anything, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me if a couple of them upset their next round opponents and made third round, and then you never know.
Well, speaking about the British crowd, you're someone who's played at Wimbledon. You've experienced kind of the crowd getting behind you. Now, we see at some of the slams, some of the home players, they actually struggle with that and it's something that gets them down. Do you feel that for the majority of the Brits, this is a helpful thing for them?
You'd say so. It is a huge thing playing, obviously, in front of your home crowd at a home slam. And obviously, you put that pressure on yourself because you want to perform as best you possibly can. It's probably the one time of year that you have friends and family and the whole crowd behind you as well. So it's just a case of how they deal with it. But I think a lot of the girls and the guys have played at Wimbledon enough to know how to deal with it so they can use it to their advantage. But obviously, it can be quite stressful, but I think they're all experienced enough to use it in a positive way.
Well, they dealt with it all right in the first round. Let's give a little bit of a mention to Harriet Dart, because her draw's opened up a bit now because of Garbiñe Muguruza. I think, I hope I have this right. Roz is rushing to check me.
Yes, it has.
Okay, so Muguruza's out. I think that would have been her second round opponent.
That would have been her second round, so she'll now face Beatriz Haddad-Maia. The rest of that quarter is still... Vekic is out as well, so... Yeah, there's only Barty and Bencic in this quarter of death that we all talk about. Because when the draw came out, this was utterly bonkers. You had Barty, you had Muguruza, former champion, you had Vekic, who's no slouch on grass, you had Sharapova, you had the defending champion, Angie Kerber, in there. Oh, and Serena Williams as well, who's won a few slams,
exactly.
I hear.
But it's quickly falling apart, isn't it? I mean, opportunities are opening up. And could Dart be one of those players that has a real opportunity? Because she's a very focused young lady. We saw her in Australia against Maria Sharapova. She got crushed and she didn't take that well, but she seems to have kind of learned from that. I mean, she was pushed against Christina McHale right in the first round, but found a way to come through. Anna, thoughts on Dart?
I think she did really well to come through against Christina. I think it was a tricky match and she'll be pleased to get that first Wimbledon victory behind her. But Haddad-Maia is a tricky player. You know, she's lefty. I know probably grass isn't her preferred surface, but obviously she's not a slouch having beat Muguruza first round. So she's come through qualifying. She's had four matches in a row, so she's going to be feeling confident. So I think, if to be honest, if Harry got through that, I think that would be a very impressive victory.
Well, it's been impressive so far, really, from the Brits too. I mean, even though many of the opponents have been ranked lower, just to be able to come through under the expectation, you know, the media coverage of these players has definitely heightened. There was a lot of media coverage around Paul Jubb, 19-year-old, who made his main draw debut. And he was up against Joao Souza, who, was he top 20 seed, I think?
Yeah, definitely seeded.
And went down in four sets. And he really struggled in that first set. It was pretty much a whitewash. Do you think the external pressure and the suddenly heightened profile? I was looking through the newspapers one day. Everyone was leading with Paul Jubb. Do you think he took much notice of that? Do you think that was kind of on his mind?
He didn't see. I mean, he seemed to handle it really well. He was in Eastbourne, and everybody like came down to Eastbourne. And you know, if there was one story about the tragic circumstances of his parents' demise, there was a thousand. And he dealt with them very, very well. I mean, that first set, everybody was watching it, thinking, "Oh, bless him." But he really rallied well to come back. And sort of stay in the fight. So, you know, his plans are that he's taking the rest of the year off. I don't think he's going back until the end of the fall.
Okay.
And working out how many classes he's got left to do. He's definitely going to go back and finish his studies, but he is going to play a bunch of pro tournaments. Hasn't really decided whether he'll go back to the States and do those there. I think he should, because then he'll be closer to that college support structure that he's got. But it was great to see Cam Norrie talking about him, because Norrie does by the numbers stuff when you talk to him in press. But I got a one to one with him where he was sort of saying, "I'm so proud of him. You know, what he's done is immense. You know, and if he wanted to come for advice, I mean, like, what advice can I give him? He's just won the NCAAs." But all of the Brits are very, very proud of him and are welcoming. And also, I quite like to see a young man of colour sort of flying the flag. And he's just so unassuming. And he came into press and was just like, "Yeah, that was a bit of an education, wasn't it?" You know, but you know, I think he relished it. And the late night crowd, you know what it's like, the late crowd that all sort of are grouped on an outside court. And I stood up on the media balcony and just watched them all jumping up and down and screaming support. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing experience for him.
Mm. Just a quick update. Novak Djokovic has taken the second set against Dennis Kudla. So that looks like he's comfortably through to the next round. No surprises there. I just want to touch, Anna, on playing at Wimbledon and playing on centre court, court one. And I know that this is probably quite an obvious question to answer, but that crowd, and we've seen it over the years, Tim Henman with Kafelnikov, I believe it was, that he beat in that sort of coming of age contest. We saw it with Ruzetsky, we've seen it with Heather Watson, these young players that come through and win games, perhaps don't progress too far in the tournament, but it's those games that really spark the career, isn't it?
Yeah, you can gain so much inspiration and momentum. If you have a good victory at Wimbledon, for example, you know, you can take that for the rest of the year and really use it and just take massive amounts of confidence. It can really boost, you know, your trajectory and how high you go. I don't think anyone can underestimate how much the home support does help you and how much it can increase your level, and it just is a massive thing. And I don't think people can quite understand, unless you kind of play on those big courts and just understand the adrenaline rush and things like that you get. But it can be a massive thing. And obviously, I guess Paul can use it as a kind of a learning experience, and obviously something that he'll want to replicate year in, year out, and play Wimbledon. And all the guys, you know, the younger ones as well, they'll want to use that and learn from it. And obviously it just gives you a taste of what can be achieved with hard work, and obviously they're all going to want to be there year in, year out. So it's a huge thing.
Johanna Konta as well, we haven't spoken too much about her yet. You mentioned the first year, the second year and the third year there, Roz. I mean, this is a case in point now, right? With Konta, this is a huge year for her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I inwardly, you know, I did think she would struggle a bit with the transition clay to grass, just because she's not had a year before where she's played that well on clay, gone so deep at the French Open, had to knock Nottingham out of a schedule, which was a week less on grass, to kind of get going with the rhythm. So I kind of had doubts about, you know, how she would do at Wimbledon. But so much is dependent upon the draw, you know, and if things keep opening up the way they do, I think there's clear chances for her to go deep. She wouldn't be up there as like a lead contender for me. I'm going for people like, probably, I mean, we'll come to this later in the show, but I'm looking at Barty, you know, Kvitova, that kind of player. But, you know, she's With the Brits having done so well in the opening rounds, there's almost a little bit less of a spotlight on Konta than there usually would be. And I'm wondering if that might be a bit helpful to her. I mean, Anna, I know you think a lot of Konta in the mental department and how she handles herself there. I mean, does it even matter how much attention's on her at the moment?
No, I don't think so. I think after the French Open run, she gained so much confidence. And I think Jo's always been a confidence player. And, you know, she does have that inner belief, but nothing can beat having matches. And obviously she got 5 matches at the French Open and probably got a lot further than she thought she would. And then once she kind of goes on there, she can go on a roll. And, you know, once she's on a roll, she can beat anyone. And I know you're saying maybe she's not a lead contender, but, you know, with the seeds dropping the way they are, you know, there is potential. So, you know, I think she stands a good chance. And just looking at the way she's playing, she's not playing necessarily at her best, but she's just so focused and so relentless that even if, you know, she's not on top form, that she's going to be hard to beat.
Mm. I really see a return to the kind of mentality that she had in Australia when she, you know, several times came from a set down. And the winning might not have been the prettiest we've ever seen, but who cares? It's a W. And we're seeing it. Although her section of the draw is pretty meaty. She's got Siniaková next, which is not an easy draw. And all the Czechs seem to be born being able to play on grass, even though they don't have a blade of grass at all in the Czech Republic, apparently. She's got Sloane Stephens as her probable seed in the third round. Then if she comes through that, she's potentially got Kvitova, who is in a kind of, I'm not going to play John the days off, because she's getting over this forearm tear, as she calls it, which I adore. But yeah, she, you know, so she's like kind of, nah, I'm not going to practice. I'm lucky I don't need any hits. She's just still got a long way to go. But, you know, if she makes it to the second week, then I agree with you. Then on her day, she can beat anyone.
Okay, well, we're going to pay the bills now, but just to let you know, after the break, we're going to focus on the rest of the week's action, the beginning matches of the doubles. I'm very excited to discuss Nadal Kyrgios. Very looking forward to hear what you've got to say about that. And, of course, Andy Murray and Serena Williams.
This is Love Sport.
Yes, this is the Tennis Show with me, Matt Beadle, joined by Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith and Roz Sattar. Now, we are going to look ahead to some of the third round matches and the rest of the second round matches to come up. The main one I want to talk about, and one that everybody seems to be talking about, Rafael Nadal against his arch enemy, Nick Kyrgios, the bad boy of tennis, as we so often hear. Now, there is beef between these two. Let's not beat around the bush. There is beef, and it's always blown up in the media. And to be fair, Kyrgios fuels some of that with some of his comments, we have to say. But is this, Anna, is this one going to be fiery?
I think it probably will be.
Come on, it has to be.
I'm trying to be a bit impartial, but no, I think it is. Pretty much after Acapulco this year, when Kyrgios started doing the underarm serves against him, and I think Rafa wasn't too pleased with that, and I can understand why, but I think they probably would each say that they have a mutual respect for the other, but they probably just don't get along the best. So I think it's probably the highlight of the second round matches, and I think Kyrgios had a bit of a long one in that first one, and then I think he tanked the fourth set, didn't he, or something, and, you know, it's a bit of, you know, typical Kyrgios, but I would expect him to come out on top form against Nadal just purely because of the kind of the history that they have. And he always loves performing on the big stage against the top three. So I wouldn't be surprised if Kyrgios wins that one, to be honest.
Me neither. I've got this as a win for sure.
Well, I just want to touch on Kyrgios himself and the fact that he almost, like I said, fuels this bad boy of tennis persona. Is this just bravado? Because I often think sometimes the media can portray a sportsman to be a certain way. With Kyrgios, it seems like he does it all himself. We're looking at what, in excess of £30,000 of fines this season. There was the incident, I can't remember what tournament it was, but he seemed to gesticulate something or other with a water bottle. You know, he said that he can smell blood when he plays against Rafael Nadal. There's another quote, he's my polar opposite, he's super salty, he said, and he said that they'd never go down the Dog and Fox, which is the pub in Wimbledon, I believe. But is this just bravado, or is there really an angry young man in there?
I think there's a troubled young man in there. I mean, I think a lot of the behaviour that we've seen, especially in the French and in Rome in particular, where the crowd were egging him on, and then when he finally realised that when the supervisor was called that he'd gone too far and packed up his stuff, the crowd were like, "Whoa, no, wait, no!" It's like, we can't have it both ways. You can't egg him on to behave like that. And then when he decides, you know what, I'm just going to take myself away from this. He does have a lot of issues. He really there are a lot of things that need to be addressed. But yesterday's press conference, I mean, I actually watched it from upstairs in the media centre, and all you could hear around our little writing room was people chuckling because he was in such good form and he was really playing to the crowd. And what you've got to remember at Wimbledon is he's seeing new faces. He's not seeing the same sports tennis journalists that he sees all year round at tournaments. So when he sees us, it's a bit like Venus. When she sees new people, she turns on the charm. But if she sees us going in, you get that immediate shutdown. So he was playing to the crowd a little bit, you know, in terms of the kinds of stuff. I think somebody sort of said, "Oh, you know, why do you get up for these matches, you know, with the big three?" And he was like, "It's just me, bro." You know,
it really is though. No.
But he's not telling a lie. Nadal is salty when he loses, and he's salty when he's made to look, you know, stupid's too harsh a word, but when the elements of his game are shown up, like standing so far back he may as well be in Wimbledon Village, you know, you can expect Nick to chuck in underarm serves all day long, you know, tomorrow.
So how is this perceived in the professional world, Anna? Because underarm serves, there was the hot dog lob, I believe, in 2014 at Wimbledon when he first defeated Nadal as a wild card. How is that perceived? Because does that show a lack of respect, a lack of professionalism, or is that purely someone with a bit of character who, to be fair, when you look at the men's game sometimes, and we've had these four totem poles of tennis for so long in Nadal, Djokovic, Federer and Murray, is that not something that we want, a McEnroe-esque, a Connors-esque type of character?
Yes, to a certain extent I would have to agree with that. I think Kyrgios is good for the game in the sense that you want to see characters, you want to see personality, and I don't think tennis has enough of that sometimes. You know, we've been blessed having obviously Roger, Rafa, Novak and Andy as well, and they're kind of so well behaved. You know, they never put a foot wrong. There's literally nothing they ever do, and you see sort of Kyrgios come in, you know, he's trying these tweeners and underarm serves and things like that, and I think it's nice for the public to have something different, but at the same time I think he has to respect everyone as well. You know, it's like, it's a bit borderline the stuff that he does, you know, when he's hitting a tweener when he literally doesn't need to. You know, it's kind of like, well, okay, you can do it, but like, do you really need to? You're kind of like showing a bit of disdain for the game. And I think sometimes he needs to rein it in a little bit. Like, I get when he hits a tweener, he hits it probably better than anyone in the game, maybe bar Roger Federer. So I get doing that, and I'm all for that and showing off a little bit to the crowd and things like that. But, you know, the stuff that he does outside, and I don't necessarily agree with that stuff or that side of his game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see a problem with what he does in terms of his game. I mean, in that match against Jordan Thompson, he had the opportunity to win that third set a lot easily, and then he started playing up with trying to do the tweeners, trying to do the fancy shots. I think he's the only person he's hurting there, because when they don't pull off, he looks a bit stupid and he's got to fight a bit longer, which I didn't think he had the fitness for in that last match. I think that's why he tanked the fourth set, because he just didn't have the energy to win it in four. He needed to take a breather, win it in five. But in terms of Kyrgios, what I've always said is his character is great for the game. His attitude isn't always. I think those two things are very different. And I think with Kyrgios, there's this frustration because he does have an image that I don't think he really wants to have. But in order to shake off that image, you have to have been well behaved, as it were, for a certain length of time to actually shake that off. Because every time you do something small that another player might not get criticised for, like smash a racket, there is going to be a headline story on that. So if you're going to be one step forward, two steps back, you're not going to shake off the reputation that you've built up that you want to get rid of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it can be. I can remember one year, it was actually quite uncomfortable listening. You know, because the press, like the Aussie press, and to a certain extent members of the British press, hunt as a pack sometimes, and they would just poking to get a reaction after a loss. I think it might have been last year or the year before, and it was very uncomfortable listening, because you could tell that they were just going after him and going after him, and then eventually he just snapped and then everybody had their story. You know, I mean, I take exception with people that are like, kind of, oh, you know, the media just want to do this. Some of the media don't actually care. but he you know, he's got a lot of things to sort out. I think he feels that because he's done so much good work for charity, that's enough to save him. But he needs to do a little bit more, as Abigail says.
Can I flip this on its head and come at it from a journalist's perspective, someone who works in the media? Is he not a journalist's dream in a way? Does it? I'm not going to say that it makes your job easier. And from a tennis purist's perspective, you don't really want to be talking about the fines and all the misdemeanours. But he gives you headlines, right? You mentioned a headline there, Abigail. Does he give you something different to write about?
I mean, for most of the media, I think it's just a case of money in their pocket. They know they're going to get clicks off that kind of thing. Mm. Me, personally, I just hate when Kyrgios' name crops up now when it's outside of how will he play in a tennis match, because I see a troubled guy there. And honestly, I don't particularly want to talk about it because I see someone there that I think needs help. And I don't want to be sat here judging him when he needs help, you know. So for me personally, when Kyrgios' name is brought up, I am filled with dreads and I'm like, get me out of here, essentially.
I'm the same as Abigail. It's like I'm getting bored of talking about his antics. I would like to talk about his achievements. And when you've got someone like Ash Barty, who took a break at a very young age off the tour, came back, and look at what she's achieved. Why aren't we talking more about someone like her who is inspirational? Don't get me wrong, I think Nick is inspirational in his own way, and the stuff that he's doing with a kids foundation in Melbourne is very good, but he then ruins it with all the other stuff that he does.
Well, on that note then, I mean, we're going to get into predictions later on in the show, but you've mentioned Ash Barty. Discuss.
Ash, I think everything's just water off a duck's back with Ash. She's just so laid back. It's amazing. Even when she pulled out of Eastbourne with her arm, she's like, I'll be right. And you're like, okay. Topo. You know, she's amazing. And to have the fortitude to realise that she needed to take a step away from the sport and do something else. And then she turned her hand to cricket and became an instant success at that. You know, there is nothing this girl can't do.
Yeah, I think on the Ashley Barty side, you're almost in danger of kind of doing the Kyrgios thing, but in the opposite direction. Like, there's nothing this girl can do wrong, because she is she's such a role model, you know.
She is, but and the thing that it's an interesting point, because when Nick beat Nadal that many moons ago, the Aussies loved him because he gave answers in great sound bites and he was a breath of fresh air. They'd had to deal with Tomic and all that kind of malarkey. So he was a breath of fresh air and they built him up and knocked him down. I just don't see the same thing happening with Barty, because she's taken herself out of the loop. Nick should do that. Nick should go play basketball for a year, see if he can make it in a sport that he puts above tennis. And then when he invariably can't and comes back to tennis, he might be a better guy for it.
So Barty, as I understand it, right, she's not been past the second week at Wimbledon, as I understand it. Is this currently world number one, right? One in France. Is there an argument here that she's kind of crept up as a world number one? It's a bit of almost like a surprise package world number one, Abigail.
What I would say with Barty is, I mean, I've loved watching her progress, because I actually interviewed her like the week after she came back to tour, when she was ranked, I don't know, 600 and something in the world after she'd come back from cricket. And to see her steady progression has been, it's been no kind of flash of lightning or inspiring thing, but it's just been so steady. And that's what I would say about Barty. She's just steady, focused, step by step. She got a ranking up. She got smaller titles. She got bigger titles. She got the Grand Slam. She got the world number one ranking, and she did not flinch. She's not battered an eyelid the entire time. And I'm so glad, honestly, to see her at the top of the rankings, because I think we see there, even though she's not a dramatic player, even though she's not a player that's going to draw a lot of headlines or make a lot of fuss, like a Naomi Osaka, for example, I think she's almost the staying power that the tour needs to kind of have that one player that everyone's looking to beat. Because even though, you know, she's not dramatic and she's not in your face, she's steady, she's consistent, and she's at the top of those rankings because she's been consistent throughout the whole year. And I think that's great for the tour.
You agree with that, Anna?
Yeah, I do. I think she's very understated and very unassuming, and it's kind of quite nice to have a number one who's not almost like a celebrity, and actually just have a tennis player as number one as well. You know, you've obviously had Serena and Sharapova and people like that, and they've kind of, they're almost like a brand. And you kind of just want someone who's there for the tennis, which is quite nice. And, you know, she's such a lovely girl, and you know, she's number one, but you literally see her walking down the street and you would have no idea that she's number one. And that's actually just quite refreshing. And you know, I see her staying there for quite a while, maybe not number one, but at least top five, and just purely because she has such a wise head on her shoulder. She's almost like an old soul, and it's just very I don't know, it's just very refreshing.
Yeah. It is, but her coach, when she came, we actually had a one-to-one with her coach in Eastbourne, and he was saying that when she came back, the question that he put to her is, how much do you really want this? And she said, you know, all the way. And he goes, right, okay. And they had like big, long training blocks, like far longer than players would normally have to get her back to fitness, because what she was missing, obviously, was that tennis sharpness. And as Abigail says, it's just been... It's pleasingly progressive. It's the kinds of thing, you know, it's almost like you can tick them off. It's like, did well at the ITFs, tick. Did well at an international, tick.
Like a perfect storm, almost.
Yeah, won Miami, tick. You know, and, you know, I remember writing, biggest career win for her yet. And then, you know, what's next? A slam. Chortle, tick. So, you know, she can do no wrong. And I think the Aussies need to manage her very carefully.
Mm.
OK, well, we are going to get onto the other clashes in the second and third round. We didn't get onto it. Sorry, I made you talk too much about Nick Kyrgios, which is exactly what you didn't want to do.
Oh,
but coming up after the break, yes, more of the week's action, plus Andy Murray and Serena Williams.
For the fans, by the fans, Love Sport Radio.
Yes, this is Love Sport, and we are into the final round of the tennis show with me, Matt Beadle, Abigail Johnson, Anna Smith, and Roz Sasser. Just a bit of an update, sorry, is that Caroline Wozniacki has beaten Veronika Kudermetova by 2-0. Right, we are going to discuss Andy Murray and the big announcement this season, this Wimbledon Championship, sorry, that he is joining up with none other than Serena Williams in what I can describe as an all-star doubles pairing.
Yeah, it's like the Harlem Globetrotters of tennis, isn't it, really? You know, well, they're giving out spinning rackets and balls and all sorts.
Is that a concern, by the way, that people are going to perceive it this way?
I don't know that it's a concern. I think the biggest worry that the All England club have is where to put Andy full stop, because you can't put him out to play doubles on an outside court, because normally they just chuck him everywhere, you know. And it would be bedlam. Absolutely. It would be carnage, let's be honest. Mm. So I think the lowest court he's going to go on actually would be 3. It has to be a ticketed court. I mean, I can't even imagine him on 18, because it would just be carnage to try and get into that court. So that's their biggest issue, is where do you put him? And you need those courts for, like, the singles.
Absolutely. I mean, the announcement itself, I thought, was brilliant. And the way that Serena spoke to the press and kind of said, do you want it? Is that what you want? All right, done. Yeah, we're doing it. It's brilliant. Bring it on.
I think I took a while to realise it was actually going to happen. Because in her first, like, pre-tournament press conference, she was very tongue-in-cheek. Like, yeah, I'm available. And I thought, nah. Because Serena's been struggling in singles lately. And I thought, if this is the same motivated champion we've seen all these years... she won't be stepping a foot in doubles. She'll be focusing on singles. So I was quite surprised, actually, that she did actually say yes to the partnership. And I know there's that argument for her getting more matches in and for getting her form up, but she's been injured a lot recently. So I'm just wondering whether it's a wise move on her part.
Anna?
We turn to you.
I'm not that surprised that she's playing, to be fair. I think, like you said, she hasn't actually played that many matches. I know she's obviously had a few injury issues and things like that, but I think this could be a nice way, rather than slogging out on the practice court, just to get a few matches under her belt and have that kind of a little bit of match pressure, and just to get her a bit tighter for the singles. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I do think the thing, like you said, about what court they're going to put them on, I just don't... They're not going to be able to put them on a small court.
No.
That's for sure. It probably is going to be one of those... I think when they do the schedule, there's normally like 2 or 3 matches that are always to be arranged.
Yeah.
Like not before 5 p.m. And then they're going to put them on and hope that center 1 or 2 goes quickly.
Yeah.
I just can't see them going on any other court.
Yeah, because as I say it now, 3 is still a little bit out in the wings. I mean, let's...
No, 3 is the one right by the... is it centre? It's the one that's nearest the centre. 2 is the one that's back out
so,
in the thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're
so
right,
2, yeah.
Actually.
So 2 is the bigger one. Yes, yeah, so the new gotcha. 3, I think, will be fine.
The new 3
that used to be 2.
That's the one.
Yes.
That's the one.
Crikey, it's even confusing to figure out the courts.
I know.
But yeah, I mean, even then, if you put them out in court 2, it's a long old hike to get there. And, you know, many is the time that you see, like, the burly security guards and, you know, and people... sort of like trailing along behind them, so it's going to be very difficult. And we don't have this underground like thing that you can drive around with a golf cart, so I don't know how they're going to
do it. I mean, from a logistical point of view, they can't be making exceptions in this case, right? Because this hasn't been done before, I'm presuming, at Wimbledon.
I can't think of a time when we've had this much of a kerfuffle over where to put someone. It's normally the other way around, where they put someone that ought to be on centre or one out in the car park somewhere, and then there's outrage.
Can I add, I just remember I was sat on centre court for a set or two last year. I was watching Jamie Murray and Victoria Azarenka on centre court playing. So there's no real reason why they can't put them on centre court. You know, I think this was first week potentially, yeah, as well that happened. So that's a possibility. But I just want to jump back a minute to something Anna said before about Serena getting a few matches under her belt. With this partnership, do you think her aim is the trophy, or do you think she's seeing herself staying in for a round or two and then going back to focusing on the singles?
No, I think she'll be in it for the trophy. I think with her and Venus, I think sometimes they can, you know,
call it in.
Yeah, basically. if they're both still in the singles. But I think Andy wouldn't have signed in with someone who's not going to want to go all the way. Yeah. I just don't see that happening. So for me, I think she's in it for the long run if they make it that far.
I mean, I remember when she lost to Kerber in last year's final, and it was the most aggressive we'd ever seen Kerber. And I actually asked her the question, you know, have you ever seen her come out like this? And she was like, no, but next time I'll be ready. Now, they're slated to meet in the fourth round, and I think that she's got revenge on her mind. I think she's got at least Manic Monday on her mind, and to hand Kerber a lesson for really... Because last year she didn't have any opposition until she got to the final, really. Mm. And then when she got to the final, Kerber was just inspired, absolutely inspired, and she knew exactly what she wanted to do to the Williams game. And I think the fact that she's saying, I need matches, means to me that she's gunning for 24, not necessarily for a title with Andy, but if that helps her get to that aim, so much the better.
On paper, right, this is an unstoppable pairing. How will her opponents, be viewing this? I mean, you're coming up against Andy Murray and Serena Williams. Like I said, on paper, that is indomitable, basically.
Slightly terrifying, not going to lie. You've got probably one of the best returners in the men's game, and then
the best server.
Probably the best server ever in the women's game. So I'm not really sure how they're going to be breaking or anything like that. So you'd probably have to say that whoever's got them in the first round, I think Alexa Garacci and
Mies,
yeah, they're going to be absolutely, they must just go home now.
But at the same time, we have seen big players, big name players partner up before. For example, Djokovic and Nadal have played doubles together before in an event. They went out first round, right? So these players, yeah, they're great and they've got the status, but they don't have the experience of doubles that much and playing together as a partnership.
But I think that, like, the Djokovic and Nadal, they definitely don't have that as much experience. But Andy has played with Jamie in Davis Cup. However, Andy never listens to anything that Jamie says. So quite often you'll see Jamie shout, Jamie's for a ball. And Andy's like, yeah, I'm going to run and hit it. So I think the problem that we're going to have, both of them have played doubles. Serena's doubles pedigree speaks for itself. I think they're going to have to really work hard at sticking to their roles on the doubles court, because I can just see Andy with his new bionic hip running everything down. He'll probably run the opponent's balls down as well, just for a bit of extra exercise.
Well, I can see him doing that in the first round anyway, because the last time I saw Serena play doubles, she seemed very much out of practice in that discipline. She didn't seem to like being up at the net and was letting her opponent, her partner, do a lot of the work.
Who's she partnering?
I can't remember. I just remember seeing
it. So it wasn't Venus then?
It might have been Venus. But Serena doesn't play much doubles at the moment. That's my point. So is Murray going to be carrying a bit for the first couple of rounds? And is that going to be good for him?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that he's going to carry her per se. I mean, you obviously have to look at Andy and the fact that he is such a good doubles player as well in comparison to, you know, sort of what Novak and Rafa are. I think it's a very different kettle of fish.
Sure.
And obviously Serena's got that pedigree as well. And I don't think, once you have Serena looking at you on the other side of the net as her opponent, it doesn't matter how many doubles matches she's played. She's never played another doubles match in her life. You're going to be a little bit worried about what's coming. So I don't think she's going to have any problems, and I think it's probably only going to benefit her singles as well, you know, get some extra serving practice and returning, her looking to volley a little bit more. So I think it's only going to be a positive for her.
Have you faced her?
No, I've never. Serena's not one I've actually played before, thankfully. I mean, I would like to, but yeah, no, kind of thankfully at the same time I haven't. No.
Abigail, we've got 1 minute left. I just want to quickly ask you about the upcoming games tomorrow and the rest of the week. What is your pick of the bunch?
Well, Kyrgios versus Nadal, obviously, is the one to watch in the second round. But I have to say, there's an upcoming third round match between Simona Halep and Victoria Azarenka, who came through. And, you know, these two have faced off a lot in the past. They've had one of the most memorable matches I remember seeing on the women's side was their duel at the US Open a few years back. You've got a counterpuncher against a power player and two women who... are playing for a lot in that match. So on the women's side, I'd say that's probably the pick of the bunch as far as the third round goes.
Brilliant. Well, that's it for another week. Abigail, Anna and Roz, thank you very much. As far as debuts on the Tennis Show go, I think I feel like Corey Coco Gauff, I'm going to say. Quite happy with this one.
All right. I thought you were going to say you're 15 years old. And
we'll see you next week.
This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio. So some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.